the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first, it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day, 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history. And
welcome once again to a brand new episode of Sake on Air, broadcast from the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association here at the Information Center here in Tokyo, Japan. My name is Justin Potts, and I am joined together today by three other of our lovely, talented co-hosts. With me today, sitting right next to me today, I have John Gottner. John, how are you doing this morning?
I'm well, thank you very much.
It is morning.
It's been a while since I've appeared here.
It is.
It's been busy, but I'm glad to be back.
It is. We're happy to have you back. And next to John, Rebecca. Rebecca's here.
Hi.
Good morning, Rebecca.
Back. Yes, it really is the morning. I haven't seen one of these for a while. Especially on a Sunday.
So we don't usually, we don't do morning recording sessions very often. So if everybody's slightly loopy or confused or a little bit off kilter today, that'll be our excuse. And last but certainly not least, Chris Hughes.
Hello.
How you doing, bud?
Yeah, nice to be back and nice to be with a slightly different crew for a change.
It is.
Yeah.
We've been mixing it up more here now that it's we nice. Got Rebecca and Marie. Now that you guys have joined the ranks, we've been having a lot more interesting combinations of
more diversity in the sake community. That's what we like.
That's what we're working on. That's what we're working on. Excellent. And today, John has prepared a little something for us. We're going to be looking at sake rice. Rice types, sakamai, specific varieties used to make sake, as well as what they often refer to as table rice, some of those different varieties, some of the trends, how we ended up where we're at, and where things might be going with regards to the world of rice and sake is what we're going to, that's the rabbit hole we're going to venture down.
And it's a deep one.
It is. It is indeed. And it is indeed. So we're going to do our best to try and stay on topic and to the point. Not always our forte here on this show, but we'll see what we can do. With that, maybe I'll pass it over to John. You want to get us started here?
Sure.
What do we got? Where do we start today?
Well, I think we should start with the concept that sake is actually brewed from rice. No other fermented material is used in the production of sake. So all the alcohol, all the flavor, everything comes from rice. They don't use any sugar adjuncts. They don't use any other kinds of fermentable materials, just rice and rice alone. And I think that is one of the things that makes sake pretty unique compared to beer and other alcoholic beverages. I think that a lot of people, at least in the West, or at least from where I'm from, think pretty much that rice is rice. It's all the same. When in truth, absolutely nothing could be further from that reality. There's hundreds and hundreds of types of rice. There's a bunch that are used in sake alone, and that's what I'd like to talk about today.
Yeah, so right now, what, there's about 100 registered varieties.
I actually counted
of sake
them.
Rice, right?
There's about 120.
Okay.
The other day when I counted them.
Okay.
And we're talking about the short grain variety, right? Because there's actually like you've got short, medium, and long grain. And I think medium is used a little bit overseas to make sake, but generally long grain is not used at
all.
Yeah,
generally long grain is not used. But again, we're talking Japonica.
Japonica.
Right,
yeah.
Which is short grain rice.
Exactly. Well, so we're looking at we're talking about sakamai. We're talking right now specifically about what they refer to as sakamai. And
yeah.
those varieties cultivated specifically for the use in sake production.
That's right.
Pedantic?
Yep.
I think that sakamai can refer to any rice
that's
used
right.
in
yes.
sake.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
That's
correct. Shuzo kotekimai.
Yeah, the shuzo kotekimai, yep. I think, is the brewery-specific rice, right? The brewing-specific, yeah. Or however you want to translate
it. They also call
that.
It jozo-yo in the rice reports.
Oh, that's right.
Shuzo kotekimai.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So anything, any rice, any short grain rice can be used and very often is used in making sake in Japan. But any stuff that's used in sake brewing is going to be called sakamai. But the 120 specific varieties of rice that are designated as being good for sake brewing are collectively known as shuzo kotekimai. We'll call it sake rice here, though.
Yeah.
Keeps it simple, I think.
Yeah.
So what I like to say when I talk about sake is this, and it's a bit of an oversimplification, but I stand by it. More than anything else, rice is going to lead to flavor. Certainly there's other things that are going to lead to flavor. The temperature at which you ferment, how long you matured it, whether or not you pasteurize it, the yeast that you use, the way you made the koji, for heaven's sake. But more than anything else, I like to say that rice is connected to flavor. And rice is connected to other things well, texture, weight, all kinds of things. resonance, as I like to talk about it. But more than anything else, I think rice and flavor are connected. However, I always like to add that the connection between rice and the final flavor in sake is not nearly as well connected as the choice of grapes and the final flavor in a wine.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that people that have studied wine need to shift gears to look at the rice and the relationship between that and the flavor in sake. However, that's not saying it's not important. It's extremely important for countless reasons. It's just that the connection between the choice of rice and the final flavor or nature of the sake isn't as tight as a connection between the choice of grape and the final flavor in the wine.
I absolutely agree with that in terms of just my interaction with people from the wine world who, you know, there's, you know, so many sommeliers, people who are wine world focused, developing an interest in sake, which is so fantastic. And it's there's such a compatible conversation between the two fermented worlds of wine and sake. One thing I have just observed is that there's more emphasis put on, oh, what rice is this? What rice is this? What rice is this? And naming the rice, as you would name the grape that you're brewing a wine from. And as John said, I think that there is perhaps because of the different culture, and we do need to maybe draw a subtle line underneath that point of, you know, rice is the carrier of flavor, but it is not the be all and end all of flavor when it comes to a bottle of sake.
Yeah, everybody's looking for that, for that one to one.
In the world of wine, it's this. What is it? To me.
Yeah, and that being said, and I don't want to take us down one of these rabbit holes. Maybe we can get into this a little bit later, but I have a feeling, and without a doubt, rice is, as you said, is not going to play the role that a grape variety is going to, you know, play equivalent to the world of wine. That being said, I'm starting to get a feeling that not just the type of rice, but the way in which it was grown, how it was grown, and the variety specific to those conditions has probably more influence on flavor than a lot of the education up till now has stated.
Yeah.
I think we're starting to rediscover that actually it is more significant. And can be more significant. To what degree? As an industry, we're still figuring it out. And a lot of brewers are still figuring it out in the context of their own conditions and what it is they're making, what they're trying to do. So the answer to that question is still probably 10, 20, 30 years out. But I think down the road, we're going to find that it actually is significantly more influential than...
You say it as if it always has been, but I think it's more of an evolution. I think brewing itself is evolving to kind of bring more out of the rice.
Exactly.
But it also comes down to the fact that what rice contains versus grapes, and it's a completely different beast, right? It's a different constituents, and a lot of the things in the grape are actual flavor creating things, right? You've got phenols and, you know, acids that you don't get in rice. Generally, I think grape is built to produce more flavor than rice to begin with.
Perhaps. Yeah, I said it's never going to be a one-to-one, but exactly to what degree does that rice actually play a role in that? I think we're still, as an industry, we still have to suss that out.
Definitely.
Next, in this line of things that I wanted to talk about, are the fact that if you look, we just spoke about sake rice and how it's used to make sake, although they can use regular rice. But my point here is that sake rice and table rice, in other words, rice designated for eating, are different in many significant ways. I'd like to launch into some of the ways that those are different. Starting visibly is the size of the stock. Sake rice stocks are significantly taller, maybe about 25 to 33% taller than table rice on the average. So size of the stocks are larger. Secondly, the size of the grains, too, are visibly larger. You don't have to be a rice farmer to look at table rice and sake rice right next to each other and see that the sake rice is, on the average, probably, again, about 25 to 33% larger than its table rice counterpart. On top of that, sake rice actually has more starch in it than regular table rice. Now, starch is cool because starch gets converted into sugar, and that gets converted into alcohol and carbon dioxide. So we like starch, and sake rice has more of that in it. Furthermore, sake rice has less fat and protein in it. Fat and protein can lead to character, but also to off flavors and rough flavors. So we want higher starch and less fat and protein, and that's what sake rice gives us. By the way, people often ask, can you eat sake rice? And yes, you can. There's no problem with that. However, it doesn't taste as good because of the lack of fat and protein that's involved.
And it's quite chalky as well.
Yeah, I had it with curry once, and I didn't realize I was eating sake rice until the brewer at the end said, That's my wife's sake rice.
Once I was harvesting Yamadanishiki in Okayama, and we had onigiri rice balls made with Yamadanishiki. Yeah. Probably the most extravagant onigiri I've ever had.
I said, it does make relatively good paella, actually.
It
turns into a pricey paella. But whether or not the price can justify it.
It absorbs the flavor from the stalks, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's actually pretty tasty. And just
Another big difference between sake rice and table rice or regular rice is that the physical constructions of the grain is such that in sake rice, you've got the starch in the center and fat and protein around that. Mm. Now, in truth, all rice is like this to a certain degree. Mm. In all rice, you've got starch more in the center and fat and protein around. But with sake rice, it's so much more the case. They're so much more clearly separated. You've got so much more starch in the center and so much fat and protein around the outside of the rice. And this is one of the most important aspects of sake rice that there is. The reason this is important is because we want the starch, we don't want the fat and protein. So when they're clearly separated like that, all we need to do, and I make it sound simple, but it isn't for heaven's sake, is grind away, mill away, polish away the outside of the grains. And as we do that, we take away the fat and protein and leave only the starch behind. So these are some of the things that make sake rice different from table rice. The size of the grains is not the only consideration. It is an important thing, but there's more. The ability to absorb water, how readily the rice will dissolve in a fermenting mash in the Maromi, that's huge. There's some sake rices that dissolve very readily and predictably. Mm. And that's very good for sake breweries. They can know what's going to happen and they can get the flavors they want out of it. However, there's other rices that, as interesting as they might be, they just don't dissolve, or they dissolve much more slowly. Or not as easily.
When you say dissolve, basically the way the rice, it's kind of breaking up, right, in the water. So it releases the components inside being the starch.
Yeah, it breaks down, dissolves.
No, it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me, but I find actually some people, when you say dissolve to them, it doesn't make sense to them. Well,
break down into components. Yeah.
And that's where the skill of the brewer comes in terms of making the koji that is going to be able to effectively break down, dissolve, put in every your favorite word for dissolving here, that particular rice into the tank. And some varieties are easily dissolvable styles. Some are more difficult to dissolve. Mm. And then year by year, season by season as depending if there's like a typhoon before the harvest, whether it's a very dry summer, you know, these things will also...
Heat, sunlight,
all of those things will have impact on that year's rice. So actually every year when I, you know, gather together with brewers at Craft Sake Week, the most common conversation I hear floating around the booths is, how was your rice this year? It dissolved too easily this year. You know, and people like sucking their lips because their rice wouldn't dissolve easily. You know, so I think it seems to be a constant concern of brewers each year. What's the rice going to be like?
Yeah. Brewers will know from the weather and other things how the rice is going to dissolve and how it's going to perform. And they make every adjustment they can to make it the same as last year. So the whole goal of sake brewing is to have consistency from year to year, unless they obviously make a conscious change. But for one given product, unless you're going to make a conscious change to it, you want consistency from year to year. So you're actually going out of your way to minimize the differences from year to year. Whereas in the wine world, you make the most of them.
Some brewers are also recently... starting to highlight that yearly, that annual change in the seasonal cycles. I'm thinking of a brewer down in Yamaguchi who does put vintages on all of his sake because he grows his own rice and he believes that each year nature delivers him that rice, but in a unique form for that year. And so he labels with a vintage so that because he remembers what that particular rice was like that year, and he would like other people to experience it too. You know, it's a little bit of a niche thing, but it is.
Yeah, but it's a good niche.
it's a niche thing, but it's being done.
It's very, very. It's very. I think it's a very positive way to do things. Very interesting.
Definitely.
But you're right too that I don't think everybody can keep up with that. No. You know what I mean?
No.
It's still going to mean on a small scale. I think we should probably quickly. We keep talking about how the rice dissolves, and make this a bit more clear. The more quickly the rice dissolves, the richer and fuller your flavors are going to be. Mm. So if you want a lot of flavor, you want a rice that dissolves easily. If you want a cleaner, more compact style, then you want rice that doesn't dissolve too quickly. Mm. And if you're trying to make a particular style, but the rice dissolves more quickly than you expect it to, you're hosed, because you're going to have big, rough, big, and bouncy flavors, which is what brewers tend to want to avoid. I think predictability is a big part of it as well. If it's going to dissolve too quickly, you can't control it.
Right.
Right? If it dissolves at a nice, measurable, predictable, controllable pace, you can make it do what you want much more easily. Moving on to the next point, I think this is big. I'm constantly surprised, or very often surprised, when I meet people that are under this understanding. Most sake is actually not made using sake rice. Premium sake is almost always made with proper sake rice, but most of the market is not premium sake, right? So most sake in the market is not made with proper sake rice. You don't have to use sake rice to make it.
To our listeners out there that aren't aware of the distribution of the market, can we just give a general overview?
Sure.
Last time I looked, it was around about futsushi, which is like table sake. To draw an analogy, it would be like box wine, maybe? The box wine category of the sake market. That's around about, from my last recollection, about 60% of the market, loosely. Then that means that around about, I believe loosely, the other 40% is graded. So the sake is graded according to the polishing rate. And then another 10% of that is for sake used in cooking, food, products, etc. Is that correct, John?
I think it's very close to being correct,
right.
So when we're talking about table sake, that is pretty much 100% made with table rice, with a few exceptions.
Sure, with a few exceptions. There's always exceptions in the sake world to everything. But yeah, it basically doesn't make a whole lot of sense to make a sake that doesn't qualify for one of the premium grades with premium sake rice.
But you know, one reason why brewers will use table rice is because, and this might sound slightly contradictory to what we've said, but you know, table rice can actually be better to make some types of the kind of the cheaper sake. If you want to make mass-produced sake and you want to make it quickly, the thing about table rice is it will actually dissolve a lot quicker than sake rice because it's generally softer. And it will absorb the water, it won't absorb the water faster exactly, but it kind of, you know, it absorbs the water more naturally, if you like. So if you want a quick fermentation and you want all that rice to be turned into liquid alcohol at the end of the day, then you would use table rice. And it's cheaper as well, so it makes sense from a cost perspective.
Once upon a time, a man called John Gartner told me a story that in the Junmai boom, there was a lot of brewers in Miyagi Prefecture were using regional rice to make their junmai sake, but because that rice was officially table rice and not sake rice, they couldn't get a grading.
Well, you can. In other words, as you know, there's a lot of table rice used in sake, right? Mm. And you can put a tokutei meisheishu, a premium grade, on the bottle as long as it's been inspected. It doesn't have to be proper sake rice. So you can use koshi hikari or any one of a million nihonbare. And it just has to pass one of the inspections.
Generally, I think they would use a sake-specific rice for the koji.
Yep.
But the actual rice that provides the fuel for the fermentation, that's a good way of referring to it, I think, basically, they're probably more likely to use table rice.
Well, if they're going to use table rice anywhere, that's
anywhere,
where
that's going
to And that's a great way to cut cost.
Yeah.
Right? If your koji is made extravagantly and properly using proper sake rice and good sake rice.
Yeah.
Then when you use the straight rice that you add that just fuels the fermentation, the best way to save money is to use a run-of-the-mill table rice for that.
There's some good table rice is out there as well. In Yamagata, they're using this Tsuyahime, which is fantastic, which creates fantastic sake.
You've seen a lot of sakes in the last just 5 to 10 years start to switch over to local varieties of table rice, not necessarily the Hitomebore or, you know, koshi hikari or these other local varieties, table rice, and they're figuring out how to make really fantastic sake with those in their own specific styles.
And my limited experience in the long, long history of sake brewing history, areas which are large rice producers have got a solid rice source. I think perhaps what I've been seeing, and again, this is just my experience, areas in the Tohoku region, areas on other parts of Japan that don't have the ideal climate for growing the big famous five sake rice, I seem to see a lot of table rice varietals coming out of those prefectures.
You can grow rice pretty much everywhere in Japan.
Mm.
And you can actually grow pretty darn good rice pretty much everywhere in Japan. There are regions that are, quote unquote, better than others, but it's completely feasible to grow just about everywhere. And then with climate changes and things like that, all of a sudden Hokkaido's becoming a premier rice growing region, whereas 20 years ago it was pretty much unheard of. But so you can grow good stuff pretty much everywhere. But with as producers are starting to dial in on local and they're unable to compete with the big five or whatever, the big five varieties are not able to, maybe it's cost prohibitive for them to get their hands
supply
on that
as well.
Supply, they have it's difficult for them to get that, to get their hands on it. They're looking for other ways to add value to their product and in doing and make a great sake. And looking at local again is another way of doing that. And so you have a lot of places that are either A, trying to develop new varieties that can compete with those Yamada Nishiki or Gohyakuman Goku or those different types of things, or look to varieties that were already there, like table rices that were great in and of themselves as something to eat that can also make delicious sake. Or go back to varieties that had made of like sake rice that had sort of fallen out of favor, that maybe at the time when they were available or people were experimenting with them, they, for one reason or another, again, they sort of fell out of favor or other things became prioritized. But maybe that specific variety at that time wasn't really grown or experimented in that region, or the style that was maybe popular at that time that wasn't necessarily ideal. Mm-hmm. Given those certain conditions, but now that there's a lot more exploration as far as what makes a good sake, and individual breweries looking at what's our good sake and sort of re-examining that, they're starting to go back and re-examine those varieties that had sort of that maybe didn't catch on at a certain time, and so there's potential in there. Yeah,
but there's actually another massive motivation that people need to understand about why eating rice is now being used so much. And I think, you know, everyone should know right now that in Japan, generally rice production or rice consumption is falling very, very fast. And eating rice just isn't being grown in the bigger quantities that it used to be. There's a lot of rice fields that are actually just being abandoned in these local areas. And I think it's more of a fact that the regions that have this very big sake rice producing culture or history can survive off that to an extent. But these other regions, when they're not even able to grow table rice right now, are really struggling agriculturally. So in a way, I think sake rice actually, you know, growing sake rice helps them to use these rice fields that have been abandoned. And it's possible to actually adopt these eating rice fields and kind of convert them into sake rice fields. It takes about 5 years to do it, but it's possible to do it, to change the soil and stuff like that. So I think it's the big motivation here right now is basically we need to grow eating rice. If it's not for another purpose, that's fine. But we really need to grow eating rice in Japan right now.
The reality is that most, and I imagine we've probably touched on this in previous episodes but most rice farmers are unable to sustain themselves growing rice in the current system. Yeah. They're just not paid enough for what it is they're making. And so in order to do that, a lot of farmers are looking toward sake rice as something that they can make, that they can get more money from.
Because it's value added.
It's value added, exactly.
And then guaranteed supply. It's guaranteed supply at one price. They don't have to compete with other, you know, if they find a brewery and they become their kind of contracted, you know, farmer, they've got pretty much guaranteed supply for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, but different prefectures, different regions, they register different rice varieties as things that they can use for sake rice and label it as so. So let's say, for example, if Yamada Nishiki in a certain prefecture is not registered as a variety of sake rice that can be grown and is registered there. If they were to grow Yamada Nishiki, use it in sake production, and make a product from it, they wouldn't be able to write Yamada Nishiki on the label. But in order to get it registered, you have to have the cooperation, not of just the brewers, but of the prefecture. So you have to have that support system that wants to get that sake rice in there. They see that as something that is value added, that's going to add to improve the brand, the quality of sake in that region. The other way to go is to create another type of rice, which can be a 10-year process at least in order to do sort of bring something like that to market. Or looking at value added again, in a market that isn't quite so obsessed with sake rice right now, you can take a variety of table rice and being something local, that becomes your value added. Because growing sake rice in a lot of cases is riskier as well, too, just due to the nature of the crop. And it poses unique
agricultural challenges for the farmer. It is more challenging to grow and to grow well. And so depending on the entire ecosystem sort of that region and the relationships with the farmers and the brewers and those things, how are we going to create not just a good sake, but value added to the region, to the brewer and all those different things. And so you sort of have all of those factors and playing on one another.
Revitalizing the region as well. You've got this big kind of thing going on right now. These regions, kind of their populations are dropping, and this is a good way of kind of bringing people back into the region and revitalizing the region around rice growing.
Whether it's table rice or growing local sake rice or developing local sake rice, a big reason that the various prefectures will do that far away from the traditional centers of good sake rice is regional economics. I mean, Yamada Nishiki is the most widely grown sake rice out there, and it is, in the opinion of most people, the best sake rice out there, meaning it's predictable. You can get it to do what you want it to do. And Hyogo Prefecture has done an absolutely outstanding job of marketing that and promoting that.
And also controlling the strain as well.
And controlling it, that's right. Mm. It's actually never officially left Hyogo. Put that aside. I'll let you do with that what you want to do with that. But it's expensive, and they do a good job. They do a good job of enhancing their own local economics by promoting that all over, but it's expensive. So I think a lot of brewers in other parts of the country are like, look, if we could develop something almost as good or even better or just as good as Yamada Nishiki and use it locally, we benefit our local agricultural environment. So it just has a lot to do with local economy as well.
I mean, we've been seeing over the last 10 years, prefectural rice is just exploding across the market. Yep. It's been incredible.
It's hard to follow.
Every time I go to an event, I'm like, what? There's another.
That's right.
Tochigi's got another rice strain.
Yep. Five to 10 a year. Some of them will last the test of time, some will not, but they're coming out left and right. In terms of the inspection thing, though, I think, as you pointed out, in other words, you have to have it inspected or you can't use it in a special designation sake, in a tokutei meishoshu. However, the problem is that you've got to maintain inspectors, train them, and keep them on staff for every strain of rice that you want inspected. So if you go to the government and say, look, we've got this new rice, but we're going to grow like one field, they're like, well, no, I'm not going to bother to train somebody and maintain them just for that. But if they can see that it's going to be a significant contribution to the economy in the long run, then they'll do that. So very often when we have people using local rice that is a decent rice but hasn't been inspected, it's because they're just making it for themselves. There's not enough to have the government justify training and maintaining a staff of inspectors just for that.
There is also a slightly different angle on that. Brewers that are labeling their sake as futsushu, when it is made with sake rice, it is inspected rice, but they're not wanting to use the name of the grade that the rice polishing rep would give that particular sake. And that's for multiple reasons. Mainly, some brewers are not wanting to put too much emphasis on the grading and focus the consumer's attention more to the brand name or the expression in the bottle. And so some brewers are choosing to register their sake as futsushu to remove that requirement. So I think that is a very small trend, but I see it as an interesting trend that is growing and one that we should watch and ask ourselves, well, why is this happening? If brewers are choosing to do this, what's going on with the grading system that's not working for them? And that's another conversation to be had another time. But there are futsushu that are indeed maybe Junmai Daiginjo.
Right, by spec.
Yeah, and I guess, Rebecca, what you're referring to, the reason that is significant is because a lot of the brewers that are doing that are, a lot of other brewers are looking to that movement as an example of ways to, again, getting back to like value added and communication and things like that. However, it takes a brewer with a bit of marketing savvy and confidence to be able to make that happen, and it's not easy. Right. Up until now, a lot of the brewers have relied on pre-existing systems in order to help them sell their product and communicate and market their product. So those that are going that route are going their own way. And so they're very, in a lot of ways, they're very much a lot of pioneering, especially right now. And so it's super exciting to see. And I think you're going to see probably more of that sort of looking at that as one means of, adding that value and doing that, but it's challenging. It's a challenge.
Well, that's the focus of this conversation is on sake rice. I think that you know, this is an interesting conversation because, in fact, the more that you polish the rice, the less rice there is, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it is, obviously, it's a really important conversation to have when we're discussing rice, but I think it's also one that it really just needs a full block of time to sort of tease out because it's a pretty complicated topic with lots of opinions on both sides of the fence. But I think it's important for the listeners to know that there is actually this little percolating movement, and it could become something actually quite significant in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in the wine world, you get bottles with the grape variety actually written on the front, and I was just thinking, like, how often does that actually happen in the sake world, where you actually get a bottle with, say, for example, you have an Anishiki on written on.
And Hyogokin quite a lot.
Yeah, I would say on the bottle, I would bet 25-30% of the time.
Right, so it's 25-30% of the time. So that's the thing, because in the wine world, I mean, you've got like where the appellation's on the bottle that tells you what grape variety is. You've got to know that. But then there are situations where there is no appellation, so they write the grape variety on the bottle. And I would, you know, it's... That's probably something that the consumer is going to concern the consumer, especially if they're wine drinkers, because they're going to go and, you know, look at the sake bottle and be, what's the rice made out of? How do I find this out? And if it is as important as you say, or, you know, why isn't there anything written on the bottle? It's not an easy one to answer.
In that case,
what?
Well, I think, number one, the back label is also an issue of sake, and that's another whole show in itself. Often if consumers... Listeners, if you're out there, if this is something that is an issue for you, I would recommend that you, if you can, look on the back label, look at what the English translation of the name of that brand is and go to the brewer's website. If they're exporting, they will most likely have a website. If they don't, they'll definitely have a distributor in that country, obviously. Usually on the homepage of the brewer or the distributor, there would be more information about, more specifics. The back label, is a problem throughout Japan, which we are working on. But that would be my advice, just a practical solution if you've got that question.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, definitely.
The internet.
Yeah.
As much as it pains me to say that, it's a great source of information. Yep. For
Google it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's too bad that we have to ask them to make that extra step to get the information that they need. But the resources are generally out there to a degree.
Yeah, so. No, that's true.
So interestingly, and again, I think this is a stark difference from the wine world, is that sake brewers do not grow their own rice. Mm. Very, very few of the 1,200 sake breweries in existence grow their own rice. And of those that do, none of them grow 100% of all the rice that they need to brew. And I think that's an extremely interesting aspect of the sake world. We do have more and more brewers... I guess it's a movement, but it's not a huge one yet, growing at least some or part of their own rice, contracting farmers to do it so that they get it done exactly where they want to do it. There are those that don't own enough rice fields, so they actually rent barren or unused rice fields to grow their own rice. So you do see that happening more and more. And it is a very interesting and good movement, but it's not really practically possible for most of the industry to move in that direction. So again, that's another stark difference from the wine world and a very interesting one, I think. Most brewers do not grow their own rice.
And that's because it was actually prohibited for a long time.
Yeah, it was prohibited for any business entity to grow rice at all.
Yeah.
Which led to the fact that only registered farmers could grow rice, which led to the distribution that exists because you had to have agricultural co-ops that helped the farmers distribute that rice.
So the whole thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The whole way that brewers get 99.99% of the rice comes from that original reality.
Then they slowly relaxed the rule, didn't they? First, they sort of allowed brewers to actually go and source the rice themselves from other farmers, and now they are actually allowed to grow their own rice. But it's a very recent...
And
very,
as soon as that law changed, we saw it in the market, didn't we? That year, when the year after, it was just boom, at the Izakaya, everything was jizake, which was like local sake, local rice. You know, that's when the movement really put the foot on the accelerator.
Yeah, I guess I don't see it gaining too much traction beyond the current state. A little bit, slowly. Mm. But the reason is, you know, you've been brewing sake for all these years, and all of a sudden you start to grow rice too. It's a completely different business. Mm. Do you have the land? And if you do you have enough land? And do you have the people? Do you have the experience? You might as well just leave it up to the rice farmers that have been doing it for a long, long time. It's just so much easier.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But that's just my personal opinion on how far that very interesting and very positive trend will go.
I think it's definitely works for that kind of small, medium-sized brewery that is looking for to create a sense of place, create a sense of locality, to create a sense of something that's actually very, very unique to their brewery. Some brewers are not just only growing their rice in their area, they're also growing it Domine style, you know, influenced by the wine world and fields around the brewery. That's a very even smaller sub-trend. But, you know, for those kinds of breweries, it works. But I agree with John, on a mass scale, it's not practical. Or even logistically possible, I don't think.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess it's, well, you got, and those small to mid-sized breweries, you have to remember, also make up like 95% of the breweries in Japan.
Yeah.
So if you look at the number of breweries that are starting to dip their hands into that are actually quite a few, but can that make up 100% of their production? Probably not. Then you kind of have to look at, exactly for the same reason that John said, it's just not practical for a lot of these places that haven't been doing it for decades to all of a sudden jump into it and start doing it, which is why you have more places contracting with local farmers. And so, which is a neat approach, because you can look at it as, are the brewers the ones actually growing the rice, or are the brewers in control of their access to the rice? And so maybe they're not the people who are making the sake aren't the ones actually out there tending to the rice fields, but there are more and more producers that are for essentially in more or less in control of all of the rice that comes into them because they contract all of those other things locally with other farmers.
Or it's a collaborative kind of, a co-op kind of system.
It's a cool part of the story, actually. You hear a lot of these brewers, they actually like spend half of the year brewing, right? And then sometimes the farmers come along and actually help them with the brewing. And then they kind of reverse roles. And then the brewers go down to the fields and they actually learn how to grow the rice. And I think what's important here is that historically, it kind of goes back. It's going back to the roots, if you use the pun slightly, grown. You know, it's basically, you know, that's the way, before that law was put in place, and we're talking a long time ago, brewers were growing their own rice, you know? I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, but kind of brewing began with the rice. They have this saying in Japanese, right?
The brewing brewers begins with the rice.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm saying it's complicated. It wasn't the brewers themselves.
They own the land.
They own the land. My understanding is that the original brewing started because of basically leftover rice, and then, you know, they were actually like growing, making sake with it. And of course, the original sake brewer, well, at this time that I'm talking about, the sake brewers were actually themselves rice farmers. So it's kind of, you know, it's a little bit different. But
yeah, and this is a bit tangential, but I think it's really important. As sake breweries are looking to get more young people to come and work with them who want to make sake and who want to do that, those are people who demand full-time employment. And so as sake breweries look to ways, how can we justify bringing somebody on full-time? Because that's not something they've done for a long time because it was very seasonal, but that just doesn't work for today's young people. They want full-time employment. They want, you know, insurance. They want those coverage and all those things. And so, okay, what can we do in those other seasons? What makes sense getting into rice production or being involved in that in some way, shape, or form gives them work those other 4, 5, 6 months out of the year that they can then afford to bring on full-time people in order to do that.
Also, some brewers have a couple of fields purely to draw people to the brewery, to take part in the process, to connect with sake from the rice field. And it's, you know, a great way of the brewery gathering people in their community from further afield, foreigners taking part, children, teenagers, older people, who knows who they are. But, you know, so many people want to connect with nature, and having rice fields and growing a small yield of their own rice is a great way to bring people into the brewery and take part in that process.
It's much more accessible than shuffling 20, 30, 40 people through a brewery when there's people working and doing those other things. To go and sit outside and picnic on a nice sunny day is much more accessible, and it brings people to a way that
definitely,
you know,
yeah,
yeah, really.
Yeah, breweries make a big event of this, don't they? Like Rebecca's saying, they bring in the entire community and like school kids and things, you know. And because these days you don't actually grow the rice by hand. You use like tractors and things like that. But the old-fashioned way is to kind of plant by hand and things. So what a lot of these breweries do is they kind of, you know, they purposefully do it by hand for maybe one day or something, and to sort of let people experience, you know, how rice is traditionally grown. And like you say, it gets people involved in the community.
And then a lot of times after they do that, then the brewers or the farmers go through and do it again because they
have this is true. And they put the photographs up on Facebook, just like, you know, it's like, well, you did a good job, you know, but this one's kind of lopsided, you know.
But yeah, for those who are visiting Japan, though, if you are here in either planting season or harvesting season, generally April, May for planting,
lots
or if you're here, you know, September, October, and that. Take a look if you have a brewer that you really like, or that's something interesting, and poke around a little bit, because there are a lot of places.
Near Tokyo as well. You don't have to
and
go too far.
The Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center might have some information on hand, some pamphlets in English and Japanese about various breweries. You might even be able to ask the staff if they know of any information about something in the area. You know, the information bureau is a really great place to come to gather these kinds of resources.
Absolutely.
We need to stick a big eye on the front of this building, I think. You know, the big tourist information center. Yeah. Can I just quickly elaborate on what you were talking about before about, you know, like providing work for the whole year? Just for our listeners that don't know, originally Sake was kind of... So I was talking earlier about, you know, this originally being the rice farmers who were actually brewing sake. And so those are the people who became those things called... those people called toji, right? The master brewers. And originally they started brewing because they don't have anything to do in the winter months, and it provided seasonal work for them. So traditionally, brewing was seasonal work, and nowadays, because of maybe, you know, changes in climate, or breweries can actually cool, you know, the inside of the brewery or whatever, so they can brew in the warmer months, whatever the reason, breweries have started to brew all year round. And so that's kind of one reason now why they need to come and be growing the rice so they can provide work for the employees during the summer months. Because traditionally they're not brewing during the summer months.
Moving right along?
Yeah, moving right along.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about sake rice and table rice and things like that. Japan has 47 prefectures, and almost every single prefecture grows a little bit of sake rice. To my understanding, the three that do not are Tokyo, Kagoshima, and Okinawa. And Okinawa isn't really suited to growing wet rice cultivation. Kagoshima has only one shochu distillery that makes a little bit of sake, and Tokyo doesn't really have the space or the need for it. So almost everywhere grows at least some sake rice. As we mentioned, if you drink a lot of wine, there's a whole bunch of grape varietals out there. But if you remember the top 10 or so, you're good for probably 80% of your wine. Would you agree with that?
I'd agree with that.
Mm. So again, same for sake. I know there's 120 varieties of sake rice currently being inspected, currently registered. But if you remember the top, I don't know, 8, you're probably going to cover 90%, maybe the top 10, 90% of the sake you're going to drink. We mentioned a couple of times the main or the most widely grown and arguably the best sake rice is something called Yamada Nishiki. Next would be something called Gohyaku Mangoku. I believe Miyama Nishiki is next, and Omachi is after that.
Yeah. And I think that Dewa Sansan and Akita Sake Komachi are rivaling each other for
the number five
spot.
Dewa Sansan is definitely all over the place.
But I think part of that is also because Yamagata Prefecture has released a new sake rice for Jumai Daiginjo specifically. So the pressure or the demand for maybe Dewa Sansan within Yamagata might have slightly just dropped as they picked up the new rice grain and used that in production. So that might just be a little an anomaly, given that there has been this launch and a lot of focus on it in Yamagata Prefecture. And at the same time, there's also a lot of popularity of sake coming out of Akita Prefecture at this time. So it might just be a little blip in the road. Dewa Sansan has held onto that number five position for a long time, but it could be fifth equal for a while.
Yeah. And so people understand, like, why has Yamada Nishiki kind of, you know, been able to hold the throne for so long? It is really incredibly rare, my understanding is it's really incredibly rare to actually manage to succeed in developing a rice to rival Yamada Nishiki. It really is almost like a miracle, really.
Well, every prefecture in the country is trying to.
Yeah. They've all tried. And they come out and claim, right? They come out and claim, this is the next Yamada Nishiki, right?
That's right.
We even have, like, what was it? The one in Niigata, right? That's completely, the name's completely, Koshitande, right? Which is basically, the parents are Yamada Nishiki and Gohyaku Mangoku, right? And that was that. Everyone was saying, "This is it. Yamaneshiki is finished. This is the future." And I don't see that happening, to be honest. You know.
So just for a little bit of point of reference here, I'm just gonna pull up this. I got this data here.
Data.
So this is 28. So about the data is about 2-3 years old. But with regards to sake rice, Hyogo can, irrespective variety, it hands down is producing the most. About 26% of all of the sake rice in production. Below that, you have Niigata producing about 15%. And then after that, it starts to become relatively negligible. I mean, as far as amount, you got Nagano producing about 6%, Okayama at about 5%, Toyama at about 5%.
Okayama's only 5%?
Is what I've got here.
Wow.
Yeah, that's is a total. Nice. And but then if you look at that, I mean, once you start to get down to 4, 5, 6, I mean, the amount year on year you're looking at, the difference is negligible. But just those top five regions make up about 60% of all of the sake rice production in all of Japan. Hyogoken, with regards to Yamada Nishiki, makes, this is about 2 years old, about 60% of the share of Yamada Nishiki is being used. And then after that...
Within Hyogo Prefecture? Within Japan.
Within Japan. 60% of the Yamada Nishiki is coming from Hyogo.
That makes sense.
Right. And then next is Okayama making not about 9%. So, I mean, it's drastic. I mean, just about everywhere is growing Yamada Nishiki nowadays, whether or not it's registered, mm-hmm. how much it's being used. But between Hyogo, number one, and number two, you're going from 60% to about 10%.
So, John, can we just touch on why Hyogo Prefecture is the Babylon of Yamada Nishiki?
That's actually the next point I had in my bullet-pointed list. And that is to say that rice does have suitability to climate, just like any other agricultural product does, right? So sake rice, in particular, is very persnickety about the climate within which it grows. It likes particular things. Some rice varieties are good in the cold and grow better up north. Others are not so good, and they won't grow well except out west. Yamada Nishiki is particularly suited to Hyogo for a number of reasons. One is the soil, and another is the fact that you've got hot days and cold nights in Hyogo because of the way the mountains lay and where those fields are that grow the Yamada Nishiki. In relation to the mountains. Hot days and cold nights help the starches to run to the center of the grain and give you that starch packet with the starch at the center and the fat and protein around that. Another reason that Yamada Nishiki is so widely grown in Hyogo is that Hyogo Prefecture has never officially released the seeds to other prefectures. So they got the best stuff. Furthermore, if you look at it, they've got a place where they actually create the seeds for Yamada Nishiki. And I'll be honest, and they might do it this strictly for other grades, for other varieties of rice as well. But it takes like
five generations,
all from one field. And these five generations of seeds to get the seeds that they sell to other people to actually grow the Yamada Nishiki. So it's really, really extremely strictly controlled. That DNA ain't going nowhere.
So just to slightly rewind to talking about the environment that, you know, the geography has an impact. Even within Hyogo Prefecture within itself, there are small plots of land or rice fields which are particularly suited for the cultivation of Yamada Nishiki. And those areas are, I suppose, if we were to draw an analogy, an easy to understand analogy with the wine world, it would be like a Grand Cru field. And these fields are called special grade A fields. They often have the name like Akitsu, or they'd have the name
Tojo,
like Yokawa. Tojo, yeah. Also Saido, Yokawa. And within those fields are all special grade fields, but those fields have got different DNA. So the Yamada Nishiki grown from those fields has got a different flavor profile. For example, Yokawa has much more complexity and richness. Tojo is known for having a much lighter but produce more light, fragrant expression in the resulting sake. And whichever the brewer wants to choose, they'll select. Of course, because it's A-grade and everyone knows it's A-grade, it's the Grand Cru, it is priced appropriately. And because it's just small fields, it is very, very scarce in supply, which further drives up the price. So within Hyogo Prefecture, there is a grading of the different fields. And you might see something that says A-grade on the back. That's what it means.
I heard an interesting story about why Yamada Nishiki sort of traveled around Japan. So the story I heard was that Hyogo Prefecture had been using Yamane Nishiki for a long, 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 long time, going back, you know, obviously it was discovered around 1936. And then, well, discovered rather developed, right? And then the story goes that, I think it's generally to do with the rice shortage, right? So the rice, they had a rice shortage around the rest of Japan, and they couldn't make sake with the table rice anymore. And so they were looking around for an alternative. And then, of course, the competitions kind of put Yamane Nishiki out there. The other prefecture saw this, and it was like, okay, we want some of this. This is making really good sake. And then Hyogo started to kind of sell it around. Is that true, you think? It's just a story I read in, you know, it's in a book or whatever. But
I haven't heard anything going against that. One thing I did hear, though, was that during the war, because of rationing, all rice had to be sold within your own prefecture. And so the brewers in Nada, which is in Hyogo Prefecture, where Yamane Nishiki grows best, were actually using an Osaka rice and had been using that Osaka rice for decades. And they knew it, right? And they were happy with it. But then they were forced all of a sudden to use rice from grown in Hyogo Prefecture. And they say, well, Shogunai, let's try this Yamane Nishiki stuff. And then they're like, whoa, this is actually much better for making koji and things like that. And that's when they switched over to the Yamada.
Yeah, it took a little while for it to actually take hold because exactly.
That's the story reason you said. Yeah. It got kind of a bit jumbled in my head, but that's exactly
so everybody's drinking, it goes from one person to the next.
And then it appeared in the competitions and everyone around the was like, yeah, we want some of that. Yeah.
So it's also important to point out that rice is 99.9% of the time the result of a blending of strains. Mm.
Yeah, right. So almost all rice is crossbred, right?
Yeah.
There's only a few that aren't. But almost all rice is crossbred with other, and a lot of it's incestuous. You've got the same rice in the mother's side and the father's side. But there's a number of reasons why they'll do that. Let's say you've got this great rice that grows really well out west, but you want to grow it up north where it's colder, right? So you crossbreed it with a variety of rice that's stronger in the cold. Mm. Another one might be that it's a great rice, but it just doesn't dissolve so well. So you crossbreed with one that dissolves better. It might be the size of the shinpaku. A shinpaku is the white starch packet in the center of the grain. Sometimes that's not big enough. Sometimes it's too big. Other times it's not centered, right? Which doesn't help if you're trying to mill the rice. So there's a number of reasons why
they can cross-breed. Also, how tall the rice grows in the
exactly,
fields.
Right. Yeah. Right. If it's too tall, you can't harvest it with machines. Or it's just a real pain in the butt.
Increase the yield if you're able to grow
Increasing
it.
Increasing yields
easier,
for sure,
easier to grow. And also with the shinpaku, because we didn't mention it already. So the actual shape of the shinpaku is also really important, right? You have different shapes, like disc shaped or kind of like a fatter kind of shape or almost like really, really skinny. And that kind of, when it comes to polishing, that's quite important. And also when you're making the koji as well.
Yeah, and I guess it's important to note that while now there's a bit more of a focus on character when it comes to sake and selection, up until very, very recently, it was pretty much all about stability and risk aversion, right? So how can you make a stable product? How can you get something consistent and stable on the market?
Of refrigerated storage, modern technology.
Yep, absolutely. And then being able to consistently get the amount of rice that you want and need every year in relatively the same condition. And so, like I said, so a lot of these sake rice, the stalks tend to be taller. You tend to have a lot of grains on them, make them very heavy. Harvesting season tends to be right around typhoon season and all these different things. And so what you're starting to see now is, for example, is getting back to John's point, you're starting to see people tend to grow more early harvesting varieties and things like that. Whereas before, a lot of places used to plant in May or so and harvest in October, November. Now you're seeing places planting in March and harvesting in August and things like that. You're seeing, you know, in order to help guarantee themselves the ability to get what they need with minimal losses. And so again, so then crossbreeding, we want something that we can harvest a little bit earlier that has these different characteristics and things like that. And so
then you have these accidental ones, right? I heard about you've got these accidental mutations where they're trying to make another type of rice, and then it's sort of like in a superhero movie, like something happens and it kind of transforms into something else.
You do hear a lot of stories of, at least two I've heard. One, it's still active at a brewery in Yamagata, where a brewer saw the stalk standing out of the snow and said, this must be good, and they took it and they planted it, and that led to a whole new strain of of rice.
That sounds like mythology.
Yeah. I mean, that's Camino O. Well,
I like
Camino. So Camino O story is fabulous. Right. It's my favorite rice story. But that's another day.
That is another day. But the other is Kisui, which is grown by Yone Eto, Yonetsuru, where the farmer just saw it was Camino O, and there was a Kisui stock, well, a stock that was taller and stronger. They took that and made a new sake rice out of it. So.
There are a lot of those. A lot of those stories around.
They discovered Omachi on the road, right? It was a guy just walking around, and in fact, he found Omachi, or she could have been a she. I'm not sure.
In Okayama,
And
then it got its name changed.
I said this in another podcast, but I always wondered if Omachi actually, why it was never discovered before, because
it was 1859, but they didn't have the system in place to designate sake as sake rice until the early 1900s.
Right, okay.
They didn't bother to do that. So they used it for sake a lot, but there was no official designation until like 1920 or something like that.
So just to go back to speaking of yamashiki, omachi, gohikumangoku, miyaminishiki, these have areas where they grow best, but they don't necessarily have to grow in those best growing regions. That's correct, right?
That is correct. You can grow it. You can grow it. I grew Yamada Nishiki at home in Kamakura in a pot. Wow. I just wanted to see what it was like.
Yeah.
So you can do it. But I can grow great grapes from France in my backyard in Cleveland. They're just not going to be very good for making wine.
I learned that Yamada Nishiki is not being grown any further north than somewhere. And I think it keeps moving. The line keeps moving up Japan with climate change.
I believe it's no further north than Fukushima.
Okay.
I think that's about
sounds
right.
Sounds about right.
That sounds about sounds right. Because Yama. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So, but then again, while, Hyogo Prefecture grown Yamashiki is exceptional in its quality and its flavor, I do enjoy trying Yamashiki grown in different prefectures because it does have that. It does have that heart that I can feel. I can feel the DNA of Yamashiki in that sake, but it has its own unique regional,
interpretation.
The current running through the sake, and I love that. I love drinking sake. Fukushima. Fukushima is a great example of that. They grow amazing Yamashiki up there, as well as in Fukuoka. Great. Yamashiki is grown there.
Tokushima.
Awa Yamada Nishiki. Again, another great place for Yamashiki. In fact, there are really interesting places all around Japan that are growing Yamashiki and really, really great quality. And it's interesting to try the character of Yamashiki in those locations.
I just got back from a weekend in Portland, and that's Pinot Noir country now. I mean, the United States. I mean, you're going to see these same things happen. You're going to have amazing regions for different varieties start popping up and changing, especially with climate changing and things like that and more experimentation. And it's super exciting. That's kind of what makes it fun.
Yeah.
Hyogo's not going to go away, I don't think. I hope not.
They are growing Yamada Nishiki overseas as well, right? They've grown some in the California?
California is one of
Arkansas.
It started in Arkansas, which is really rice-growing country.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of rice is grown in Arkansas, and they got it there. And then they started growing it in Northern California as well. Nobody's saying how the Yamada Nishiki seeds got over to the United States, but that, too, is for another discussion.
Yeah.
So I would like to move on to pretty much the last topic I have. But like all of the others, it's a fairly big one. As I said earlier, and as everybody agreed, the connection between rice and sake flavors is not nearly as tight as the connection between grapes and the final flavor of the wine. Often people say, well, can you blind taste sake rices? And it's very difficult, but not impossible. For example, if you put, I'm going to go on this rant for about 3 minutes, and then everybody can jump in, but because there's about five things I want to say, but if you put a bunch of sake in front of me and say, okay, John, one of these is a Yamada Nishiki, a very good Yamada Nishiki, brewed in such a way that it maximizes the nature of Yamada Nishiki, I could probably pick it out. Or an omachi that's a typical omachi, I could probably pick it out. But blind, giving me a sake and saying, okay, what's the rice? Probably not going to happen, right? So you can't really blind taste. Having said that, I remember being at an event run by Okayama Prefecture where they had about 100 sake that were Yamada Nishiki, right? That were grown in Okayama, the rice was grown in Okayama. Then they had about another 100 that was omachi. It was like a completely different beverage. So my point is, if you taste enough of them, often enough, you can get a feel for the nature of a rice expressed through the sake. And I think that's a really important thing. You touched on that a couple minutes ago, Rebecca. So can you blind taste completely like you might with wine? Not going to happen. Can you find a thread of consistency that runs through sake made with a particular rice strain? Absolutely. The next thing I like to say is that 10 toji, 10 master brewers, can take the exact same rice, milled down to the exact same degree, and make 10 completely different sake. So really, rice is only half the battle. It's extremely important. But the way the brewer manipulates it, the way they brew it, the millions of things that happens between the time it gets to the miller and the time it gets into the bottle, even after that, will all make a different sake. And the last thing I want to point out, it's an anecdote. And they say, well, how important is the rice? And to me, this anecdote is extremely indicative of how important, but then maybe not so, sake rice can be. I visited a brewer in the western part of Japan, and they brew very close to 12 months out of the year. And they are one of these brewers that are moving away from the grading system. They do put grades, but they minimize it and put it in the back of the bottle. Mm-hmm. On the front, they've got another sub-brand name. And I remember as I was tasting with them, the owner says, we were talking about rice. He says, we went on a bunch of tangents. He says, for example, I can't even tell you what the rice is in this bottle. He says, we almost always use Yamada Nishiki, but in the middle of the summer, we can't get Yamada Nishiki, so I use a different rice, right? So I'm not exactly sure what's in this bottle right now. However, they were able to brew it in such a way that you couldn't tell when they ran out of Yamada and started using something else. And I thought that was fascinating. The other side of that coin is, I'm sure we've all had this, if you were to taste a Junmai Daiginjo or an Aruten Daiginjo, it doesn't matter, made with Yamada Nishiki grown in, for example, Tojo or Yokawa, just the resonance, the reverb, is just something so special. So yeah, rice is massively important, but then again, maybe not. And those are my observations on pretty much all things sake, but especially about sake rice. Is there things you want to add to that?
No, that's pretty much.
Well, I would, this is a fairly, I suppose this is an intermediate to advanced conversation for our listeners. So if you are listening and you are just starting your journey, my advice would be very practical, just drink. When you go to an event, you know, have a talk to the staff, or if you're lucky and the brewer's there, ask them about the rice. Start creating a mental flavor profile in your mind. Start putting those flavor memories into the little banks of, oh, this was omachi, this was gokekubangoku, this was, oh, this was yamanishiki. You know, start sort of building up experience and flavor memories, and just start to feel through time if you can guess a sake based on, you know, that expression that you know. It's going to take a lifetime, but it's a fun journey to be on. And it's not really, as John said, always about the rice at the end of the day. It really is about the craftsmanship of the brewer. So all of those things together are an important part of your sake journey. So drink a lot, ask a lot of questions, and build up flavor memories. That would be my advice on this rice-based topic day. Yeah.
I believe we have covered everything that I wanted to cover today, and we've gone on several rabbit holes.
I think.
And
I think
there's a lot of editing work to be done.
We've actually done relatively well today with regards to staying on topic.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's because we knew we had to, or the those tempting rabbit holes would just take us way off.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, but with everything we talked about, for our listeners, if there are more specific areas that maybe we touched upon that you have interest in, or that you'd like for us, you know, we talked about doing, you know, rice variety specific shows or things like that. If there's something that you're interested, that you have questions about, please do get in touch. Send us an email, questions@sakeonair.com. You can follow us at sakeonair on all of your favorite social media channels, and you can send us questions or comments or feedback that way. And we're going to continue to come up with show ideas that hopefully not just things that we want to do, but that our listeners are interested in as well. And so the more feedback you can provide us, the better. You can rate us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever you listen to us on. And all of that feedback helps us a great deal in getting word about the show out into the world, as well as letting us know what you like, what you'd like to hear more of. John, Rebecca, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
That was a lot of fun.
Yes, it's cool.
And with that, again, a big thanks to the Japan Sake Chochu Information Center for hosting us, as always, as well as the Japan Sake and Chochu Brewers Association for making this all possible. We'll see you again in a couple weeks. Kanpai.
Kanpai.